It is Tuesday, January 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump delivers his State of the Union speech before both houses of Congress tonight. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the U.S. took a hostile step in publishing a list of influential Russians. We get reaction to its release.
As far as what was made public, there's not a lot new in the list.
And a Cuban refugee writes about the last years of the Cold War in the play Blind Date. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump is set to deliver his second State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress and the American people late Tuesday. VOA will provide live coverage of the speech beginning at 1:45 Universal Time Wednesday. On the Fox News Sunday broadcast, White House Legislative Affairs Director Mark Short said, among other things, the president will emphasize that economically, America is back.
He's going to talk about where we are today as far as growing an economy that now is growing at 3% clip over the last three quarters, an economy that now has the lowest unemployment rate in 17 years, an economy that has the lowest unemployment rate among African Americans and Hispanic Americans in the history of collecting data that's broken out demographically that way. I think you're going to talk about the fact that America is open for business. And the president's also going to make an appeal to Democrats, to make an appeal to say, we need to rebuild our country, and to make an appeal that to do infrastructure, we need to do it in a bipartisan way. He'll also talk about America's strength, the fact that we are continuing to wipe out ISIS, but that we have growing threats, such as North Korea. And one of our concerns is that we have these dramatic threats on the global scene, yet where we are in Congress is we still came and passed a spending bill that funds our military, because Democrats are continuing to hold the military hostage to pursue other agenda. And he will ask that it's time that we rebuild our military to make keep America strong.
Mark Short said, citing an effort at bipartisanship, Mr. Trump last week offered a deal on immigration whereby hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants brought to the country as children could be given a pathway to citizenship in exchange for more border security, an end to chain migration, and the visa lottery program. University of Virginia political scientist and director of the Center for Politics, Larry Sabato tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Mr. Trump's first year did see some impressive economic numbers.
I think most people understand that the economy's been doing well for some time. And in fact, President Obama's last year was a very good year economically. And this simply has been a continuation of what we saw the last year President Obama's term. That doesn't stop a president for taking credit, and this president in particular. He'll take as much credit as he possibly can, and no doubt will on Tuesday.
Another goal, apparently, of this speech coming up on Tuesday night is he's going to appeal for bipartisanship in an effort to rebuild America's infrastructure.
Bipartisanship starts at home, and that really is the problem for President Trump. He's reading a speech. This is teleprompter Trump. And I'm sure his staff has written in lots of bipartisan lines that will get some applause. But that is not the real Donald Trump. That is not the Donald Trump that we see tweeting every morning. It's not the Donald Trump who makes comments to the media on the run. And until we see a change there, there really is very, very little chance of any sort of bipartisanship. I don't think it's going to happen after this State of the Union. It's not going to happen after an immigration compromise is reached, if in fact there is one. And it's difficult to see how any of this will change until Donald Trump changes, and he may never.
On foreign policy, of course, he'll speak about some of the serious issues we have, especially North Korea and Islamic State.
Well, again, this is a continuation of past American policy for several presidents. I'm sure he'll claim credit for the defeat of ISIS, although we've recently learned that ISIS has cells in lots of places around the world, so it's not defeated everywhere. North Korea is a continuing problem that will have to be managed. It isn't helped when presidents say outrageous things and call other foreign leaders, no matter how absurd they may seem to us, names like Rocket Man.
Is this a critical time for the president as we enter an election year?
He's had 1 year now of this four-year term, and his pattern is pretty much set. He ought to enjoy these Republican majorities because he may not have them after one more year. So if he's going to get any other major programs through, he's going to have to do it in 2018. In that sense, this year is very important for him.
Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia. He said it's unlikely the president will receive much in the way of bipartisanship, since Democratic voters generally detest Donald Trump, and Democratic lawmakers will not go against the wishes of their base, given the importance of this non-presidential election year. Well, following tradition, on Tuesday night, several Democrats will give shorter response speeches after the president finishes his address. It is time now for social media. A new study by researchers at the University of Sussex in Britain says people fit into four types of social media users, and those are people that use things like Facebook and Twitter. Well, these four types are geeks, lurkers, victims, or internet celebrities. The researchers say more young people are choosing to be lurkers and geeks by reducing what they select to share online to try to avoid being victims. The geek has high participation but low visibility. The internet celebrity has high participation and high visibility. The victim has low participation but high visibility. And the lurker has low participation and low visibility. And that's a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The Kenyan opposition leader takes a presidential oath in a swearing-in ceremony. 10 Westerners are facing pornography charges in Cambodia. Yemen separatists seize control of Aden. And Syrian talks in Russia are marred by boycotts and heckling. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When volcanoes erupt, they blast huge amounts of gas and dust particles into the atmosphere. Scientists say the dust and gas reflect sunlight away from the Earth, causing a cooling effect. A new study by researchers at Columbia University suggests volcanic eruptions can also worsen the melting of our planet's ice sheets. The researchers say they found evidence volcanic eruptions quickly caused severe melting of the ice sheet that blanketed a good part of northern Europe toward the end of the last ice age between 12 and 13,000 years ago. The study notes that in some cases, the erupting volcanoes were located 1,000 or more miles away. The surface of the ice sheet was darkened by the falling volcanic ash, which allowed it to absorb more solar heat than usual. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, doctors are arrested in Turkey as the government's crackdown widens on dissent. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the United States has taken a hostile step by releasing a list detailing the wealth and political connections of 210 people with close Kremlin connections. But he said there would be no immediate move to retaliate. The U.S. Treasury Department published the list Monday as required by a law passed by Congress last August aimed at punishing Russia for meddling in the 2016 presidential election. President Donald Trump reluctantly signed the law, and administration officials said Monday there are no immediate plans to impose new sanctions on the Kremlin. Michael Rajansky is director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center and is adjunct lecturer of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He reacts to the release of the list.
Well, first let me say that we don't know if there was a classified portion of the report that went to Congress. We obviously don't know what's in it. So any future effects may also depend on what the administration has said to Congress in closed format. As far as what was made public, there's not a lot new in the list. The list of essentially senior Russian government officials and then of the 100 or so wealthiest Russian business people are publicly available information. These are things you can download off of almost any internet website in Russia. The Forbes list of Russian billionaires, there's really nothing new here, and there certainly is no value judgment being made in a sense of what Congress asked for in the way that I read that legislation, the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions, or CATSA Act. The way I read that is Congress was looking for some kind of value judgment about which of the wealthy Russians and which of the nominally responsible government officials were really close to Putin in some sense. And I think what's hard about that is, number one, we really don't know that with any real authority or confirmability, and certainly to the extent that we know things, we're going to keep that knowledge classified because it depends on sources and methods, presumably inside the Russian system. That's number one. And then number two is, inherently the exercise called for in the legislation was a bit of a strange animal because it was about naming and shaming or putting powerful Russians somehow or other on notice, and perhaps those who did business with powerful Russians on notice. But it didn't actually mandate any sanctions, and the administration certainly didn't impose any sanctions. So I like to say it's a little bit like asking a teacher to kind of declare who are the good students and the bad students, but then not to give any grades. It's kind of a strange exercise.
Well, now, meanwhile, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, however, he said that this list, the release of this list, it would poison relations between the two countries for a long time. He was certainly more opinionated than Mr. Putin.
Well, I think that's a strange statement because, you know, number one, the Russians have plenty to complain about in U.S. sanctions policy, and they have done. This is not high on the list. I mean, there are U.S. sanctions now of several years' duration that bite much harder than this. This is not even sanctions. This is, again, a list you can download off of the Kremlin website or the Duma website or the Federation Council website. So I think the Russians were positioning themselves before they knew for sure what the content of the list would be, and I suspect now they're mostly just relieved.
Relieved about what?
Relieved that there really is there's no discrimination in the list. The list is just literally everybody of a certain rank in the Russian government, and then everybody worth more than $1 billion in Russian business. That's it. That's the list.
Matthew Rajansky, director of the Kenan Institute at the Wilson Center and adjunct lecturer of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. 9 members of Turkey's medical association have been detained for voicing opposition to the ongoing Turkish-led military incursion into Syria against a Kurdish militia group. The arrests are part of a widening crackdown on dissent over the operation. Doreen Jones reports from Istanbul.
Ankara's prosecutor office issued arrest warrants for 11 leading members of the Turkish Medical Association, including its head, Rashid Tukel. Police raided the homes of the doctors in the early hours of Tuesday morning. The organization's offices across the country have also been targeted. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Monday labeled the association members as traitors and servants of imperialism. The remarks were in response to the association calling for an end to the ongoing military incursion into Syria. The doctors raised humanitarian concerns for civilians trapped by fighting. Dr. Eris Bilaloğlu of the association struck a defiant tone over the arrests. He said the medical association, with calmness but also determination and insistence, has the mind, idea, heart and energy to overcome this. Nearly 2 weeks ago, Turkish-led forces entered the Syrian enclave of Afrin to oust the YPG Kurdish militia, which is a key ally of the United States in the fight against Islamic State. Ankara accuses the YPG of supporting a Kurdish insurgency inside Turkey. The doctor's detention has drawn swift political condemnation. Member of Parliament Selin Sayık Berke of the opposition CHP, speaking outside the headquarters of the Medical Association, criticised the government. This is an attack on freedom of expression, on those who call for peace. It's an attack done by those who want to kill the culture of living together in this country, Berke said. International human rights groups have also criticised the detentions. The London-based Amnesty International's Turkey representative, Andrew Gardner, tweeted the government should be protecting the association rather than detaining doctors from their beds on false propaganda charges. The Medical Association is one of the country's most prominent non-governmental organizations, with more than 80,000 members. The arrest of its leading members is part of a growing crackdown on dissent over the ongoing Syrian operation. The Turkish Interior Ministry Monday announced that more than 300 people, including four journalists, have been detained under the country's anti-terror laws for social media postings criticizing the operation. President Erdogan said last week all dissent would be crushed. With all the parliamentary opposition parties, with the exception of the pro-Kurdish HDP, supporting the incursion, there appears to be broad support for it. But the crackdown is being viewed as a sign the government remains concerned that sentiments could change as fighting and the loss of life continue. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. The 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan reversed the process of détente between the United States and the then Soviet Union, ushering in a freeze in relations and heightened Cold War tensions. Anxiety grew across the globe, with many people fearing that the superpower rivalry would someday lead to nuclear war. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports from Chicago, a new play called Blind Date by a Cuban-born immigrant explores this dynamic and the events in the mid-1980s that set the stage for the beginning of the end of the Cold War.
When U.S. President Ronald Reagan first met Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in Geneva in November of 1985, it marked the start of a Cold War thaw between two nuclear superpowers.
It was a real moment in Cold War history, in that no general secretary after the invasion of Afghanistan had sat across the table from a president of the United States.
A narrative that drove playwright Rogelio Martinez to dig deeper into an event he didn't fully appreciate at a time when he was 15 years old.
Though the play has to do with Reagan, Gorbachev, it's not. It's about me, ultimately. It's about the world I grew up in. So it's an extremely personal play, but it's also a historical play.
Born in communist Cuba, he fled the island when he was 9 with his uncle during the Mariel boat lift. So what informs the play about the historic Geneva summit comes from a personal experience, first under Soviet influence in Cuba, and later under American democracy, led by the great communicator.
I started to write the play, and I realized that Reagan himself was a bit of an enigma. He could pivot, which is a wonderful thing in many politicians. He could change. He followed his own course and his own instincts.
Which is information Martinez gleaned from lengthy letters between Gorbachev and Reagan before the meeting.
They didn't speak in sound bites, let's just say. They actually found a great responsibility in every single word they put on that page.
It had to be thought out more carefully and more critically.
William Dick portrays Mikhail Gorbachev on stage.
No! They asked for our help.
There was a huge abyss between these two people and these two cultures that could have led to a nuclear disaster. But they had the courage to reach out in the dark, blindly, to each other to make an overture. They were both skeptical. They both thought it wouldn't work. And it was difficult, but they began to talk.
Actor Rob Reilly plays opposite Dick's Gorbachev as Ronald Reagan.
A lifeguard.
Reilly says what unfolds on stage in Blind Date isn't just a serious examination, it's also infused with some humor that serves as a history lesson relevant to today.
you know, any play about international politics and leadership is going to have resonance with the present.
There's incredible optimism in the play, something that is lacking in today's times.
It's about dialogue. It's about talking, as Reagan says in the play, not talking at each other or about each other, but talking to each other, daring to go on that blind date.
Blind Date appears at the Goodman Theater through February 25th, but Martinez hopes for wider audiences and believes what makes for good theater someday will make for a good film.
This is Hollywood.
Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Thanks very much, Kane. Well, President Trump tonight during his State of the Union address, he's going to be inviting some special guests to watch this speech. The 15 guests, they will be sitting alongside First Lady Melania Trump in the gallery of the House of Representatives chamber. The guests include Corey Adams. He's an Ohio welder who the White House says plans to take money saved from the president's tax cut package, and he's going to set it aside to help finance his two daughters' education. Well, in addition, Steve Staub and Sandy Keplinger, who are Adams' employers, they're sibling founders of a manufacturing company who say they were able to grow their business and hand their employees a larger holiday bonus, because of the tax overhaul. Two couples, Elizabeth Alvarado and Robert Mickens, along with Evelyn Rodriguez and Freddie Cuevas, they're both parents of girls killed by MS-13 gang members, and they will be guests as well. Well, that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, has served the two terms permitted under the country's constitution. It is someone else's turn to seek office. A crisis ensued when Kabila failed to organize timely elections and stepped down. Following negotiations, Kabila's ruling party and the opposition coalition signed the Saint Sylvester Accord. President Kabila agreed not to seek a third term or change the Constitution. He would remain in office until the installation of his successor, following elections, which would be held by the end of December 2017. But there were no elections in the DRC last year, nor will any be held until December 2018 at the earliest. And now President Kabila's party is talking about changing the Constitution to allow him to run for another term. The president's refusal to step down and the political machinations that have delayed elections over and over again have caused a political crisis, heightened insecurity, and triggered a series of street protests in which scores of people have been killed. On December 31st, the Catholic Lay Coordinating Committee organized peaceful demonstrations where security forces used excessive force against unarmed participants. Another peaceful protest was scheduled for Sunday, January 21st. Authorities prepared for the demonstration by preemptively shutting down internet and SMS services and forbade gatherings of more than five people. When the peaceful protest nonetheless took place, they shot tear gas and live ammunition into the crowd, killing at least seven people, injuring nearly another 100, and arresting dozens. We condemn in the strongest terms the violence perpetuated by the DRC security forces on January 21st against church-led peaceful protests, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. We are appalled that the DRC government, including President Kabila, would employ repressive tactics and disproportionate use of lethal force against civilians, including religious leaders and children, exercising their democratic rights to call for credible and inclusive elections, she said. The use of lethal force against Congolese citizens and the cutting of internet and SMS services undermine the democratic process, obstruct implementation of the Saint Sylvester Accord, and contravene international human rights norms. We call on President Kabila to hold accountable security force members who fired on civilians or ordered the use of lethal force, and urge him and his government to ensure a peaceful and open electoral process process so that credible elections are held as scheduled in December 2018.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.